Awesome. Hi, folks. Jason Gank, Director of Parks, Recreation, and Libraries. We're here for the April 23rd meeting on the Stanley Lake Boating Task Force, our first meeting. And I just want to take an opportunity to really thank you. This is a challenge and a great opportunity, I think, to look at solutions from the community, to work with you as volunteers to help guide those solutions, and to, you know, take the extra time and effort, which you've already done via email and our correspondence, has been absolutely fantastic. I can't thank you enough. As I've said in the email, my role is simply as the initial facilitator. I am here to help in any way possible moving forward. Should you need supplies, should you need tours of the lake, should you need whatever, I'm going to help in that regard. But after I kick things off, I'm actually going to step away and be here to support you and to listen. As you know, as part of the process, the recommendations that are formed by this group go to me for reviews. That's why I want to be careful just to make sure I'm not directly embedded in the task force. With that said, based on the correspondence I've had with you so far, you guys are fantastic. You really are, and diverse backgrounds and that sort of thing. So if you folks wouldn't mind, since this is the first meeting, if that's okay, if you guys wouldn't mind just doing a brief introduction, folks, is that okay? Okay, whoever would like to start.
Me, okay. Well, my name is Tammy Wines. I have lived in Westminster for 26 years in the same house right behind Stanley Lake. I use the lake three, four times a week, even in the winter time. And a few years back, I was a trail ambassador for Stanley Lake. So I love the lake.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
My name is Megan Lahotsky. I grew up in Arvada, Colorado, and I still reside there. I do have lots of family that currently reside in Westminster. I grew up boating at Stanley Lake. That's where my passion of water sports came from. And then I went into a long-term 20-year career in the water sport industry in Colorado. So I'm currently managing a big dealership that we have here. I participate with all the Colorado Marine Dealer Association background, as well as the water sport industry side of things. So I'm happy to help out wherever I can and just look forward to hopefully coming up with a great solution that really works for everyone and protects the water source. So I'm just really excited about the opportunity. Thank you for having me.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Well, my name is Wayne East. I've been a resident of the city for most of the past 36 years. I went away for college. But I've got a bachelor's degree in wildlife biology and a master's of public administration. I've worked in the natural resources sector my whole career in the public sector of natural resources, one of which was the water conservation, first full-time water conservation coordinator for the city of North Glen. So I became very familiar with Stanley Lake during that. Right now I work for a government agency, and one of the programs I oversee is aquaculture. And as part of that, I also serve on two statutorily created boards that deal with aquaculture and fish health. I also am an angler. I think we've got an angler on the. There we go. an angler, and I also enjoy occasionally going out and doing some power boating as well. So I think that I bring a diverse background. I'm also representing the Parks, Rec, Libraries, and Open Space Advisory Board. I'm currently their co-chair.
Thank you, Wayne.
Thanks, man. I'm Steve Garrett. I've been a resident since 1980 and a permit holder since 1986. I'm a retired division chief from Denver Fire, so I'm used to handling public safety issues. And I also want to say I have firsthand knowledge of the mussel problem, because as firefighters, we had our own timeshare in Lake Powell, and we've had to replace two lower units in 2016 that were caked with mussels. So, and I would also like to have my grandkids learn to water ski like the rest of my children.
Sure. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
I'm Gary Johnson. I've been a Westminster resident for 15 years. I've currently been in my residence for 13. I'm blessed to be able to wake up every day and see the lake and enjoy the beauty of Stanley Lake. It's amazing. I'm a fisherman. I love to fish the lake on a boat from shore. I like to ski. Well, let's just say this. I've drank more water from the lake being a boat anchor than a skier. So I also have a paddleboard, and I like to paddleboard the lake as well. I'm happy to be here. This is a great opportunity, and I just want to be here to come up with the best solution possible.
Fantastic, diverse group, and I really appreciate your passion. Thank you so much. So hopefully everyone should have in front of them this very specific binder. And this binder is really for you to, hopefully, to be helpful for you to utilize throughout your meetings. If you want to reflect back on any of the material, and I know some folks have printed it already, great, thank you. But if you want to reflect back on any material that we discuss in the meetings, this will be readily available. What we've included in here, and I'll just very briefly walk you through, is starting with the MOU, which you've already familiar with, the council agenda item regarding the decision, which I'm sure you're familiar with, agendas, a section on agendas, which we'll add as we go, of course, at the meetings, the Stanley Lake Boater Suggestion Report provided by the Friends of Stanley Lake, as well as the updated Zeke, also in that same section, which is, I'm on, by the way, after the yellow tab is where I'm at. And there's a second document in there called the ZQM Prevention Process, which I believe was handed to council last night. And then after the green tab, there are all the solutions that staff has tracked as best they could, as timely as they could. Granted, this information was sent to you last week, so if staff received more recommendations, we would be adding them sort of as we go to add to that section. Additionally, there's some resources there on the Zebra Mussel Program, somewhat background of the program at Stanley Lake, and some other helpful information. One other thing that I wanted to be sure to give you right now, and by no means meant to be overwhelming in any way, shape, or form, but this is hot off the press, and you had mentioned an email. We have a picture of a prototype of one of the solutions that was provided by the Friends group. And it was attached to an email. Sorry, I mean, if you don't mind adding that to the Friends section. We're going to get to that later, but I just wanted to make sure since it's hot off the press. There you go. Hot off the press. Sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
If you'd like, you can put that in your section if you'd like for the yellow tab, which is the suggestion reports area. We'll get back to that, like I said, later. Also, as requested by one of the board members, by one of the task force members, is the official part of the Watercraft Inspection and Decontamination Procedures Manual. Extra thick manual, sorry about that, a lot of information, but we just, again, I keep stressing efficiency. We want you to have as much information as you need to bring forward solutions as quickly and as efficiently as possible. By the way, behind Wayne over there is a stack of bags I just grabbed on the way up. I'm giving you a lot of things. If you want to use one of the open space bags to take home, feel free if that's convenient for you. Let me just get into the one thing on the agenda for this evening. And to be fair, the agenda was circulated to the group a couple of times just asking for any additions. And in fact, a couple of additions were created, which is to talk about the overview of the city's boating quarantine program, which will be a brief presentation by staff, as well as an overview of zebra and quagga mussel threats to Stanley Lake, which again will be a very brief overview for you this evening. And then, of course, moving forward through the agendas. Those additions were made by the board to help inform and provide the process. The other items, frankly, were recommendations that, in the spirit of helping the group move efficiently. So the first thing I wouldn't just... Yes, sir.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Yeah.
For those who might be listening, might be good if we did an intro also of those staff members who are here as advisors to this group.
Sure. You want to do that as they come up? Is that okay?
Sure.
Awesome. Thanks, Max. Max Hirschbaum, by the way, Director of Public Works and Utilities, my peer. So thank you, Max.
Just want to make sure that great catch. Know who's available here for them.
Yeah, well, no, let's go ahead and go with that, Max. Appreciate that. So if folks that are staff that are here that are either going to be presenting and or supporting this evening in various ways, go ahead, Max, if you wouldn't mind, just stand up briefly, reintroduce yourself, and then we'll go through the folks.
I'm Max Kirschbaum. I'm the Public Works and Utilities Director. My piece of this is the water quality aspect, and we'll kind of do this in by our departments. I'll ask Sarah to introduce herself as well.
My name is Sarah Borgers. I'm the Water Resources and Quality Manager. So from a utilities perspective, Stanley is where most of my work resides.
Can I interrupt just real quick? When you're introducing yourself, can you please come up closer to the microphone?
Get up by the mic.
Sure. Could y'all hear me okay?
I could hear you.
I'm Kelly Klein. I'm the Water Quality Administrator for the City of Westminster, so water quality of Stanley Lake is my thing.
Thank you.
I'm Holly Walters. I'm the Lake Operations Coordinator at Stanley Lake.
I'm Rod Larson. I'm the Open Space Manager under which Stanley Lake falls.
And as an added bonus, Rod has agreed to take at least the meeting's first notes, so we don't have to worry about who's keeping notes in the car. Fortunately, Rod, I don't know, he said he volunteered, to give him full credit. He volunteered to do that. We can talk about that in a minute, though.
And then just one last person, Chris Holdren is here with us. He was with the Bureau of Reclamation. He was at the April 2nd meeting, if you were able to listen to that. He's an expert in the field and is available to answer questions.
Awesome. So we wanted to try to give the initial response based on the agenda that was formed. And these staff are not direct to the task force. Rather, they're your resource to the extent you'd like. And by the way, other staff and other resources that you brought in, we'll talk about that in a minute. But if you don't mind, briefly, just on the first red tab there in the MOU, I wanted to state a couple of key things, both for the task force as well as other folks that might be listening and following along. The charter for the Stanley Lake Boating Task Force is online and on the boating website, which is on the city's website. You've already received this. This was part of the application process to agree to this, to be part of this task force. And again, thank you. You all did just such a great job in that process. A couple of key things I did want to point out. The Stanley Lake Boating Task Force will evaluate options for restoring trailer boats to the lake without compromising the quality of the water. The objective is to work collaboratively to address issues of concern associated with the trailer boat program at Stanley Lake, specific to ZQM, resulting in a broader support for decisions involving trail boats and water quality. Skipping down to the points of agreement there in item two, trailer boating, to be very, very clear, trailer boating was immediately and indefinitely ended solely due to the threat of ZQM and no other reason. The Stanley Lake Trailer Boating Program provides the greatest threat of ZQM to Stanley Lake as compared to other water-based recreation programs. Flipping over to the next page here, and again, just a couple of highlights, I promise, not the whole thing. Going down to additional participants, as I already mentioned, you know, we'll have some additional participants assigned to the audience, but in no way, shape, or form does it prohibit you from bringing in other folks to add the agenda at future items, meetings, sorry. Also, really important on the goal of consensus, this task force is an advisory body rather than decision-making authority, which, by the way, takes a lot of pressure, frankly, off you, in my opinion. So when seeking consensus, each member will be asked if they concur with recommendations on solutions. But there are times when consensus won't be reached, and that's okay. And in doing so, we'll ask for what are the points of non-consensus to record to make sure everyone has the opportunity to be heard. And you know, along with that, I will mention that we definitely want to focus on the charter of restoring trailered boats on the lake without compromising quality of water. As I mentioned in the email, I think that maybe you had authored earlier in the day, that is the focus. And there may be opportunities to have other, I don't want to call it noise, but other issues. But to be real clear, we're going to be focusing very specifically on that. There are folks, certainly we're working very closely with the boating community, have recommendations. We're also working closely with the non-boating community. Many folks are following this very closely, which is why I'm so thrilled to be working with such great folks to provide advice and solutions moving forward. So, folks, thank you again. Finally, obviously, and I don't suspect any of this is going to be a problem, ensuring that all members have the equal opportunity to share perspectives, operate in an open, inclusive manner, remain flexible and open-minded, and meetings will have a start and end time. And someone already asked possibly about extending the meeting. Go ahead. That's up to you. You can establish that protocol if you wish. But at the same time, we want to be respectful to what you signed up for which was in the questionnaire, and I realize you have very busy lives too, as well as respecting the public process too, for folks being aware of those things. And then obviously we want to maintain on our focus solely on solutions moving forward. So I'm going to leave it at that as far as the MOU, and I didn't know if the group wanted to introduce, you know, it's kind of, you know, referenced on the next agenda item, frankly, which goes into community assignments and establishing communication protocols. Folks, those are just draft items. You could run with this. But I don't know if you wanted to create other protocols or agreements on process. You are very sharp folks, committed, and I want to be very respectful to your process. So that's really up to you. So I will, you know, Wayne has already agreed to help chair moving meetings and things along, but that it's up to you if you want, how to extent you want to continue that. Rod Larson, Open Space Manager for tonight, has agreed to take notes. Staff would be happy to continue to take notes if that's what you want, but that's entirely up to you guys and any other protocols. And including, by the way, communication. We're getting communication. Are you comfortable with me just sending that directly as a group? Or as you get communication, how do you want that sent? And or do you want an automatic link, let's say, that automatically distributes to all of you? Those types of things, just having done a lot of advisory groups before, just those common basic understandings so we don't lose each other, are things that perhaps you wanna discuss.
Are there any thoughts on that?
Yes, I want to know where I can send correspondence to, documents that can be shared with everybody. Do we do it via email? Do we drop it on a server? What is the easiest communication for everybody? Personally, I like email, but we also need to, I would like a source to store information, documents, and have access to those.
Is it like a shared drive or something like that that we could have access to?
Mm-hmm. What do other committees do?
Does everybody here have access to computers, email?
I have a 10-year-old tablet. I do not have a real computer, so email is the best way for me.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, on the Westminster page, when I get the Thursday weekly, I can open that page, but I cannot scroll and read anything.
Okay, so that's exactly what I'm talking about. We could, by the way, we could have duplicate processes, and we'll work hard to make sure that those are as tight, obviously, as possible. So, for instance, we're happy, I'm interjecting just to say we could really do both. We could do whatever you like. We're happy to deliver these items to you. We do those things for the advisory boards and task force, but...
Okay.
It's up to you what you guys would like to do.
I'm great with emails, too, as well. That's a really great source for me, but I'm happy to use different sources of technology. And to have some place where all of these things could be stored electronically would be wonderful, too. So I fully agree with that.
Are these items up on the webpage already, the recommendations that we've received and some of the basic background information? Is that something we could put on...
Let's see. So the one we received last night, definitely not, because we just got it last night.
Right.
But we are working to get all of the documents. And by the way, that could be the venue, and perhaps, you know, that way everyone would be able to see everything that you guys receive. We'd be happy to do that, continue to do that right on the voting site, as well as provide other venues. And we can even set up some testing protocols if it's not working for everyone. We'd be happy to revisit that expeditiously to make sure you have that at your fingertips.
Well, my recommendation would be to have it in an open format, so it's not just for the committee of the task force. That way everybody that's interested could go and look at it. So we all have the same information, just be as open and honest as we can in this whole process. And I would love to see a duplicative process, if we can, to where we can make sure we can get hard copies or whatever works best for everybody else. And I do think that we plan on taking the notes. We plan on having those posted as well, so everybody will have those at the end of the meeting.
Yeah, within 2 weeks is what we agreed to do so far.
Okay.
And certainly we're going to work hard to get that done sooner, but we agreed to in the MOU in the process at no later than 2 weeks. But frankly, we should be pretty quick. Really, the only thing that typically slows that down is we'll send you the draft version of the notes, and just a matter of was it accurate or not before we post. So we could work hard on that.
Steve, did you have any thoughts?
I concur with the email and also the website. So as long as we get an email to say, hey, you need to get on the website to look at this.
Okay.
duplicate is great. And I totally support being open as well.
Yeah. The fastest means possible is ideal.
Okay. So it sounds like what we will do, if I'm hearing this correctly, we'll shoot an email to the group of all the information we receive, and that would apply to everyone, is what I'm hearing. So if you just get something, just to send it, route it through, as well as nest the information on the boating website so everyone can get access to the same material. As well as the final piece, just making sure that everyone has received that. And if not, I'll just say this right now, for every meeting, any new information staff will have printed for you to put in the notebook. So you're not worried about creating duplicate paperwork. So we'll do that as well and make sure everyone has up-to-date information. Angie, by the way, my assistant, who's sitting out there, I got to give kudos to her. She's been working so hard to make sure that we have everything we possibly can for the efficient process. So
she's been great.
Awesome. So was there any other protocols or considerations just from the task force and efficiency's sake?
One of the things that you had talked about is extending the length of the meeting. Usually how at least the advisory board works is it's a vote for us. It's up to us. If we want to extend it, we can. Really, it's just up to the members of the task force. The same as setting up our next meeting and what time will work best for all of us.
My only thing is that I would like to say is we need to do it faster than 2 weeks. We need to be very proactive on this situation.
I think that'll maybe depend on everybody's availability, but I agree. I mean, the summer's coming up, the boating season is coming up. So
let's move forward.
Yeah. Okay. We already talked about putting the meeting times and dates on there on the website. Are there any other thoughts on any kind of protocols for this task force that anybody has? I plan on breaking around 7, just to have a break for everybody, but obviously, if anybody needs to have a break, just say so. Before we get started, I want to echo what Jason said. I'm a volunteer too, but I really appreciate everybody, and not just on the task force, but the staff and everybody else who's taken the time to put together stuff like this. I mean, this is a really detailed, well thought out document. So I really appreciate it, everybody.
I do too. Thank you, everybody.
Yeah,
appreciate it. Appreciate your time.
And I had asked Jason for this first meeting. The first part of this is going to be a lot of background. The five of us all have differing degrees of knowledge when it comes to ANS and boating and Stanley Lake. And you know, you can never underestimate the value of the basics. So I had asked if we could get a quick overview of both ANS as well as the procedures up there at Stanley Lake so that we can all make informed recommendations at the end of this process. So with that, if it's okay, I'd like to start off with some of that background information and get an overview of the city's boating quarantine and decon procedures.
Going to be hard for everyone to see.
Sit right here. So, come on. The water's fine.
So I think most of you are familiar with our tagging and wire system. But I did want to just go through that just in the event that not everyone is completely familiar with that. So to start off, all Stanley Lake staff are state certified ANS inspectors and decontaminators. I've been certified by the state for the last 9 years since the program started. I'm also a certified trainer for the program. So we actually bring in all of our seasonal staff each year, and all of them get trained and certified to be state inspectors and decontaminators. So that's why you have that manual in front of you, that those are the protocols for the most part that we follow. Certainly all of the decontamination protocols for all types of ANS are the protocols that we use out at the lake. The only variation within the program is obviously the 35-day quarantine, and has been the use of their mobile application at the boat ramp. We do utilize that application, just not in the same way that the state does on the boat ramps, and I'll explain a little bit more why about that. But obviously when a boat comes in, we check to make sure that each boat has a tag and wire that's specific to Stanley Lake. The state uses green tags. All of the tags have the name of the lake of the last body of water that they visited. We actually use a clear tag. All of them are number coded. There should never be any duplicates. And then they say Westminster on them. So we know that these are specific to us. Are all of you familiar with what the boat tag system looks like? You're not, Tammy. Okay. So basically, we attach the tag and wire typically through what's called the bow eye on the front of the boat, and then around a welded part of the trailer so that that can't be removed. And then we know when that boat comes back to Stanley Lake that it's intact. So basically, after we do that, you definitely will hear a click once you snap this shut, and then the tag should be not able to be pulled back out and not reused. So I can pass this around for you, for those of you that aren't familiar with that. So when a boat comes back with a clear tag, we cut the tag. We actually have an application that we use. It has not been the state's WID application, which is Watercraft Inspection and Decontamination. IT created an application for us that was specific to permit holders. So when you come in, we log your permit number. It lets us know if we should be removing that tag, if we should be adding that tag, or if you have a red tag, meaning that you're in quarantine. If you're in quarantine, it will specify if your 35 days is up and if we can cut that tag. And if not, obviously we're not going to cut the tag and we have to wait until the 35 days are up. If someone comes to us in the middle of the season and they have a green tag on their boat from another body of water, we do run that tag through a search system. It's the administrative side of the mobile WID application. And if that green tag was put on the year previous, meaning it has sat all winter long, then we will go ahead and clear tag it, knowing that it's been out of the water over the winter. Zebra and quagga mussels don't survive the cold temperatures of the winter. And that way, the new permit holder can avoid the 35-day quarantine. We do inspect it, obviously. But as long as that tag was intact, we were going ahead and clear tagging it and allowing them to buy their permit and launch. So that's just the capacity that we were using, the state application. We have had access, and all of us have that application on our phones. An update was brought to that application that allowed for live searches, and the updated WID application was sent to us last Thursday. So we did get the updated version. The state has made recent changes to that application. And through conversations with them, we were already committed to using it in 2019. There are some shortcomings in that not every lake has an inspector on the ramp. Not every lake utilizes this system. Certainly lakes outside of the state, like Lake McConaughey, just a few hours north of us, they have no WID protocols, no inspectors. So you could conceivably launch on other lakes and there would be no record of that. So that's part of the reason in the past we chose not to use that application, even though we've all had it on our phones for the entire time. But we were going to go ahead and use it this year since it is an added layer of protection. And if someone had gone to a reservoir that happened to have inspectors on it, we would at least have record of that. Obviously, we are aware of several ways of kind of circumventing the system, if you will. We have been aware of the bow eye issue for quite some time, the loop that goes, that's usually connected to the boat. Our inspectors are trained to look for loose bow eyes. Now, it would actually require that we crawl inside every single boat to actually verify if the bow eye has been removed. That's not feasible. So we typically are just looking for loose bolts or anything of that nature. If it was removed from the bow eye, that would still leave that tag and wire attached to the trailer in some way. So if you went to another reservoir, you would have to hide either by wrapping a towel or something. You would have to tie that tag and wire up in a way that if you were getting inspected, they wouldn't see it, which is highly unlikely. Or you would be launching on a reservoir that didn't have inspections. So we were aware of the bow eye issue and have been for some time. The new issue that came up is that the tags can actually be manipulated. I brought some tags, and I just wanted to pass these around. Some of these have been manipulated, and I just wanted to give the task force an opportunity to look at them and see if you can decipher which of those tags have been manipulated and which ones have not. And then, when you're all done taking a look at those, I'll let you know which ones are. So that has been our system. We were the first park actually in the state to put together an aquatic nuisance species protection program. Our program went into effect in 2007, and a year following that, the state actually implemented their ANS program. So we were actually the first in the state to do that. We have a pretty robust program, and obviously water quality and protection has been our number one goal. So if you have any questions about our operations out there, please feel free to ask me at any time. And then, once you all have a chance to take a look at those, let me know.
Holly, I just have a couple quick questions.
Sure.
If you have just a second.
Absolutely.
The tags that went to the trailer and the wiring that went to the trailer, was that consistent for all of last year? So every boat that came out of Stanley got the boat wired and tagged in two locations?
Absolutely. And if they showed up without a tag or wire, that's an automatic decon and a 35-day quarantine.
Okay, perfect. And then I know you were explaining how the system that you would use for green tags, if people came to you and the boat had sat for a certain amount of time coming out of a public lake, but were there any people that came to you like in the middle of the season with a green tag from another lake and wanted to switch from their lake to then becoming a Stanley Lake pass holder, and how did you handle that situation?
That's a full automatic decon and a 35-day quarantine.
Okay,
yep.
So if they went through decon and then sat through the 35-day quarantine, then you would clear them for entry into Stanley.
Absolutely,
okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Can you please explain what the decon process entails?
Yes, so basically we flush the engine, any ballast tanks. Ballast tanks are a concern for us because they can't be, most of them cannot be visually inspected nor fully drained. And we do an exterior wash on them, so it's no chemicals, it's hot water, 140 degrees. That kills any Eurasian milfoil, any mussel veligers potentially on the exterior of the boat. We then flush all live wells. We flush the engine. We flush ballast tanks. We flush any compartment we can find along with any equipment. That's anchors, ropes, skis, wakeboards. Anything that comes in on that boat initially gets sprayed off. We also decon all paddle craft, which is over and above what the state does. So we do spray off all canoes, kayaks, paddle boards, anything of that nature. They do not have a quarantine. They don't have the same compartments. We can actually decon both the interior and exterior of paddle craft. It's a different risk, value completely. So, and we do flush all internal compartments at 120 degrees. We don't want to burn out anyone's ballast tank pumps or bilge pumps. So those are decontaminated at a slightly lower temperature. We did receive word from the state that the sprayers that the state and we were using, there was a lot of temperature variation going on. They didn't hold a consistent temperature. We have already installed the new system that the state recommends. It's an instant hot water system, so that the spray station already has the new system implemented that the state is suggesting.
Unfortunately, we can only do interior compartments with that. It does not have a high pressure component to it, so we would still be utilizing the high pressure sprayers for the exterior.
Gary, pass those.
Oh yeah.
Sorry, I was. I'm listening and looking at once. So, I have one question for you.
Yep.
Heidi, thank you so much for your time.
Holly,
yeah.
Heidi.
No worries. H, it's close.
Gary, Greg, whatever. Just don't call me late for dinner. How could you identify if a D-ring is removed off of the bow?
It's incredibly challenging. I mean, most of the time, we would either see loose bolts. I mean, without physically crawling inside someone's boat, it's honestly not 100%. Like I mentioned before, though, it would leave the wire still attached to the trailer.
Understood.
So the bow eye has been a concern.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yep. Okay.
Were they going from consistent places on the boat to the trailer per each boat? For the way trailer was wired?
So they're taught to always go through a welded portion of the trailer, if at all possible. Some of the smaller fishing boats, it's very challenging. But the state program has always suggested to go through the bow eye. So we have always stuck with that. Yep.
I don't have a question. I just have a comment because I am at the lake all the time. I went out there on Sunday and asked if I could be admitted into where the boats were stored. I went to 3 different boats, and I was able myself with my hand to unbolt the bolts on that little, I'm assuming that's what you're calling the I-ring. So I could definitely understand how that is a problem. But me, not being a boater, I wanted to know, well, wait a minute. So I can unscrew it on the bottom. A boater would not leave those loose. So how would they get that ring off? So I jumped up on the trailer and looked in the boat and saw the little hole in the front that I could stick my hand through and reach. And I thought I could see how that is definitely a problem.
Okay.
Yeah, some of the newer boats, absolutely, those they're actually welded in or part of the fiberglass. So it also depends on the type of bow eye that the boat has.
My vote?
Yep.
Those have all been compromised. Okay. That's 2, 4, 6, 7. 2 have not. Okay. My personal opinion.
Okay. I'm going to let the rest of you look at this. I'll let you know if you're right. Do you want to take a look at these, Steve?
Yep.
All right. Yeah, feel free to pass those around. No hurry on that.
There you go.
Thanks, Holly.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you, Holly.
Did we get an update on zebra quagga mussels, whoever's going to do that? And could you please restate your name for everybody, too?
I'm Chris Holden. I'm a consultant for the city on this project. Sarah mentioned earlier, I'd spent almost, I guess, 18 years at the Bureau of Reclamation, where my group was responsible for invasive species research. Furthermore, the main project I had, I'm a limnologist, remember, over 40 years on lake and watershed projects, and my main project at the Bureau of Reclamation was Lake Mead. So needless to say, when the mussels appeared there in 2007, things changed a lot, and I was kind of right in the middle of all that. So I was catching it from both ends, both from Lake Mead and from the invasive species. So we had people in my group that had been looking for mussels. I think they started in 1992 when Reclamation started some form of monitoring for the mussels themselves, and obviously didn't see them till Lake Mead hit. I had a friend that was at the Metropolitan Water District in Los Angeles. It was kind of the same thing. He had hired somebody back in the early 90s specifically to deal with mussels when they hit, and that particular individual retired 6 months before they were found in Lake Mead. So they were looking for a long time without finding anything in the western states. Once they hit at Lake Mead and we started looking around, my group found them initially at just about every lake we looked at in the entire Colorado system, all the way from Grand Lake, Horsetooth Reservoir, Lake Powell, Lake Mead, Havasu, all the way down to Imperial Dam. The ones in Colorado, fortunately, did not stick. We saw them in a bunch of reservoirs in Colorado, the larvae, again, not adults. At Pueblo Reservoir, it was the only one where they were persistent. They stayed there for, we were picking them up for several years on the larvae and with the genetic testing. But, we think we saw one adult. Initially, one was brought to our lab. Unfortunately, it had been sampled in the summer and was riding around in a hot car for about a week before we got it. So what we got was a shell that was covered with a whole lot of fungus. Scraping the fungus away, it looked like it was a striped shell, and our biologists were pretty sure it was either a zebra or a quagga. They couldn't tell which at that stage. That mussel was sent to another lab for genetic testing, where they found nothing and destroyed the sample, so we never got it back to get another look at it. But again, my biologists were nearly positive that that was either a zebra or a quagga, an adult from Pueblo. That would have been the only adult found in the state so far. Again, other than Pueblo, all of them where we would see positives, they would go away. Blue Mesa is an example. We saw them there over two or three different years, but never consistently and always in very low numbers. Grand Lake, some of the other, Horsetooth, we saw them once or twice and then they were gone. So it was our feeling that, and what we always tried to tell people, that it's good news and bad news. The bad news is somehow they're getting through. These lakes are getting exposed. The good news is just because the lake has been inoculated and that something was there doesn't mean that it's going to stick. The water quality conditions might not be right. The substrate might not be right. For whatever reason, they just didn't become established. Lake Mead was obviously the other end of the spectrum. Once they were found there within 6 months, some of the Park Service divers that spent, I think, pretty much the next year underwater looking at everything told me that nearly every solid surface in Lake Mead down to a depth of roughly 30 meters, almost 90 feet, was covered with mussels within that first year. And that really hasn't changed much at Lake Mead since then. Lake Powell is kind of the other end. We found them at Powell, and that's where it gets a little iffy on the boat inspections, again, from my opinion. Lake Powell never wanted to admit they were there. They had a really good boat inspection program, but you can imagine with a lake of that size, there's no way it's going to be 100%. There's just too many places you can launch. You know, my group was doing some fisheries work. We were able to launch somewhere on the Navajo Reservation from the shore. Fishermen did that all the time, and they're not going through any kind of inspection program. Stanley Lake's a little bit different. You have a little bit more control, and you don't have quite that much unmonitored shoreline, but we would see the villagers. The state didn't want us to see them, so they quit sending stuff to our lab and said, well, we had either misidentified the larvae with the microscope or we were getting false positives with the genetic testing. There have been a number of round-robin surveys conducted. It was almost impossible to get a false positive with the genetic testing. The problem there, it's negative. It doesn't pick things up as well as the microscopy. We went so far as then bump it up with the something called a scanning electron microscope, which is even more sensitive, much higher magnification to be, you know, one extra step, okay? If we have any suspect at all that it's a zebra or quagga mussel larvae, we would put it through the scanning electron microscope to verify that. So I was very confident with what our lab was seeing. Again, that whole time, Lake Powell was, they're not here, we don't want them to be here, therefore they don't exist. Then it became, well, we found three of them on this houseboat, but they were too far apart to be spawning. So this was after maybe, 6 or 7 years, when so we were pretty sure they were there the whole time, but again, in low numbers. What I wished is that they had taken a little more seriously and admitted that they were there and said, why in Lake Powell aren't they spreading, where just downstream in Lake Mead, they've covered the whole lake up in that same time period. We don't know. We don't know if it was the sandstone in Lake Powell versus the granite in Lake Mead, which is kind of the best thing we could come up with. Maybe it was just substrate. But eventually, back about, I think, 2014 maybe, there were so many in Lake Powell, they had to admit that, yes, they were indeed in Lake Powell as well. My group's experience with the inspections, again, is my personal viewpoint is I don't think inspections can be 100%. They base that on two very specific bits of evidence. One, Lake Mead Fish and Wildlife Service was putting on some training for the boat inspectors down there, again with the hot water wash. The most experienced biologist I had in my group with the mussels went down there. They had 20 people in two teams of 10 that went over a houseboat. And again, with the hot water cleaning, 20 highly motivated people looking for the mussels, most of them with experience, previous experience with mussels in some form or another. And again, at the end of each of those sessions, it said, we can't find anything. At the end of that day, a mechanic came out, took the rubber boot off of the motor where the shaft came through the hull. There were live mussels in that boat in spite of the hot water washing, in spite of 20 people going over it the best they could inspect it. Those mussels survived. The other one, one of the lakes I was sampling was a reservoir in Oklahoma. We typically would sample at the marinas and put substrates out simply because our research showed that it was either the boat ramps or the marinas were the most likely places for the mussels to come in. And I think that's been borne out by most other studies too. That does seem to be the most likely source of exposure, is a boat coming in from somewhere else and inoculating the reservoir. I want to say contaminating it, because again, just because the mussels are there doesn't mean they're going to spread. Anyway, after I had been working with this marine operator, I got a call one day. He had had a boat come in from another reservoir in Oklahoma that did have zebra mussels. The boat had been cleaned at the reservoir where it, when it left, you could see the traces, they call abyssal threads. Those are what the threads that the mussels use to attach themselves to hard surfaces. Those threads were still on the boat, but there were no mussels that were visible. Again, it had been cleaned and inspected. It had been out of the water for maybe a week or so at his marina before it was launched. After it had been in the water for a few weeks, the boat started running hot. So they took it apart. They took apart the motor. There were live mussels inside the motor. So again, inspections are pretty good, but in my viewpoint, it's never going to be 100%. The mussels are pretty tough. They seem to survive, and they can manage to be in places you'd never expect them to be. You met my friend down at Metropolitan Water District. Is part of their procedures when the mussels were first discovered. They drained the entire canal that ran all the way from the Colorado River over to Los Angeles, over 100 miles of canal, just to dry it out, make sure the mussels were clean. Then they started chlorinating the water going into that canal to make sure that the mussels weren't spreading anymore. But as part of that process, they disassembled one of their larger pumps. There was a mussel growing inside of the pump. There was a place in that pump where the water just wasn't going quite fast enough, and somehow one of the villagers had managed to attach itself. So they can get into pretty small openings. They are microscopic when they first start to attach. And once they attach, they can be pretty tough to dislodge and very tough to find. So that's why, again, when the city asked me to give my experience, I do. And again, that's why I believe that the city is going a long way. And I think that, again, at the last meeting that we were at, I heard some really good suggestions on ways you can get the boat still launched, but I don't think inspections alone are going to be the solution. That still does leave a risk for the mussels coming in. Any of you have any questions for me that I could answer?
I have one, and this is from the residents of Westminster on the water.
Mm-hmm.
If it would happen to get to where they treat the water, can they be mitigated there?
It's difficult.
If we have our water quality expert talk about that, our staff expert.
Just because
the
pipes that come down to our households, and you're responsible for part, we're responsible mm-hmm. for part. So that's my only question on that. But I concur, because I went through that with our houseboat, and it was running hot. Mm-hmm. And when we took the lower units apart, that's exactly what we found.
I mean, in terms of the distribution system, the water can be chlorinated, which is going to get rid of the mussels. We found the Bureau of Reclamation UV treatments are fairly effective at killing them. So, and again, that's what Metropolitan Water District did. That's why they drained that 100 miles of canals. They were using $1 million worth of chlorine every month or every week, I can't remember which, I think every week.
Million?
$1 million to chlorinate the however many thousands of gallons of water were going into that canal. So they were going through a lot of chlorine, but that was keeping the mussels out of their distribution system. So it can be done, it's not easy, it is expensive, but again, that's why it's much preferred if you keep them out to begin with, it's going to be a lot cheaper. But yeah, once they get in the system, there are just so many places that they can, that you have to start worrying about. I believe you said you were a fireman, is that correct?
Correct.
One of the inspections, again, my group did was down in the Imperial Irrigation District, one of their distribution systems. They turned on a fire hose, and again, it wasn't the quagga mussels, it was the Asiatic clam. There were so many of those that had gotten in the system and hadn't been tested for a while, the fire hose immediately plugged up. As soon as they turned on the water, all that water shook all the clams that were loose, put them right up to the nozzle, and no water was coming out, which is not what you want in a fire system. So what the what Metropolitan did, what the Bureau of Reclamation did, was start to use either filtered water or chlorinated water in all the fire suppression systems so that they didn't have to worry about that possibility.
I would just add, Jason Gink, again, Kelly, if you wouldn't mind, I think now would be a great time to add a little bit more information about the city. And the question was, if it were to happen, chlorine, the other processes, if you wouldn't mind, just reintroduce yourself and briefly hit a few things.
I'm Kelly Klein, the Water Quality Administrator for the city. I've been here for
I think I still had another question.
Okay. So. Hot
seat,
come on.
No, I don't want to think so.
We won't bite you.
I've been with the city for 18 years, and I was around when all this first started, and we started developing the programs. The first thing that we were concerned about when we start hearing about zebra mussels and quagga mussels is how effective they are at sticking to hard surfaces, and we were worried about them clogging our infrastructure. So our intakes in the lake, they can cover that very quickly. They can also get into the valves, and they clog up all the valves. They can also, travel fairly far through the process, and sometimes they're clogging up, at the water treatment plant itself. So we can't, what they do is they start clogging and make the pipes smaller and smaller.
They're on the outlet, and they're collecting all the food coming through. That's what they're doing.
That's part of it, yeah. But they're also releasing veligers from that outlet, mm-hmm. and we're also sucking in veligers from the inside.
I understand.
And then they'll adhere further down into the piping.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've looked at different ways that if this was to happen, how would we treat the system? And the most economical and the best way of doing it is to add chlorine into the intakes at the lake. That doesn't do anything for the outside of the intakes because they're basically just like mesh screens, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and then they clog that up. So those have to be scraped as well. So you feed the chlorine into the pipes, and that keeps them from adhering to the inside. And so they release, and if they're small villagers, it's not a big deal as far as clogging goes once we start introducing that and we can get them to release. But they're organic, right? They're a living organism. So when you add chlorine to organic material, an organism, if you will.
Or an alkaline.
They produce a product that's called a disinfection byproduct in the drinking water world. Mm-hmm. And we're regulated by the state and EPA on those levels.
Sure.
So as you have more chlorine and more organics, those disinfection byproducts go up. So that was like one of our number one concerns right there, is actually ruining the infrastructure, extremely a large amount of mechanical treatments and chemical treatments, and then changing the water quality at itself just for that part of it. The other part is when they're in the lake itself, they filter all the algae and all the zooplankton and things like that the ecology is based on. So what they'll do is they can, when you get enough zebra mussels that have appeared, they can filter like a liter of water a day. And as so if you have, you know, millions and millions and millions, which you would after an infestation in the lake, they can basically recycle all the water in that reservoir in like a day. And so they clean what you hear about, they clean the water up. Well, they certainly do that. And so what happens is the amount of light that can penetrate that lake, it can go down further into the water column, further into the bottom. And that happens to be one of the main things that certain types of algae that we're very cautious of, they're called blue-green algae. Mm-hmm. They can produce toxins, and they're very hard to treat. So from the water side, if they're producing these toxins, which we're not regulated on those yet, but there is health advisories based on these toxins. So if they do get into the drinking water and our treatment can't get it out, which is really hard to do, we not only have a do not drink order, it's a do not use order. We are not allowed to distribute that water to the citizens of Westminster. As you can tell, we would want to avoid that at all costs. That the whole algae thing is a twofold thing. So the lake is getting clearer. You have these zebra mussels that are concentrating all the nutrients, right? They've taken everything out of the water column, and they excrete what's called a pseudofeces. That pseudofeces gathers on the bottom. That's just fertilizer. It's 100% fertilizer. And the one thing that does love that is blue-green algae, filamentous blue-green algae. And a lot of those species, or several of those species, are toxin producers. The zebra mussels also, not only do they concentrate the nutrients, but they will select for all the good algae. So anything that is palatable, they will filter that out. The blue-green algae, they don't like it. They'll spit it right back out. So it has a tendency to concentrate the blue-green algae without even having the nutrient effects itself. So it's kind of a twofold issue with that. Even if it wasn't the toxins, it would be the taste and odors. We have a hard time getting out a lot of the organics, which is what you would find in an algae bloom. So you have a lot of algae growing. When they die, the metabolites that come out, that's an organic. It can actually overload our chemical processes if you have too much in there. And we cannot get it out completely. It doesn't hurt you, but it smells horrible. Mm-hmm. And it goes, you know, out to the distribution. People start smelling it, and they get up, you know, pretty upset with, you know, what are you doing to our water? So that's taste and odor is something I've dealt with a lot. Although our lake, we don't have issues with taste and odor too often. We used to. And over the years, with good sound management, we've been able to minimize that. And I would hate to go back. Any questions?
I think we've got several. Tammy, did you have a question?
My question was actually more... You had mentioned at the April meeting that Westminster's Stanley Lake had pH balances that were perfect for mussels.
Yes, in terms of the chemistry of Stanley Lake, it is favorable for the mussel growth. And I think I mentioned too the Asiatic clam is fairly common there. That's usually my argument. People say, oh, the water chemistry is off in this lake or that lake, and it can't grow. But there's a whole bunch of Asiatic clams there. I got a feeling the zebra and quagga mussels can probably grow too. So, yeah, certainly the Stanley Lake is slightly alkaline, which the mussels like. There's sufficient calcium for the mussels, so yeah, the conditions are in the kind of the high risk range in terms of the general water chemistry for mussels in Stanley Lake.
Then can you speak a little bit, too, about, I know different areas in Colorado go through different climate change, but in respect to where Stanley is located and the freezing temperatures that we do get here in the winter, can you kind of explain the likelihood of that contributing or not contributing to the risk that Stanley's put in?
I guess, sir, I'd sort of point you toward the northeast, where the mussels have been present for, what, since the 1980s, I think. They do pretty well in New York State and Vermont and some of the other northern lakes, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota. So certainly those lakes are all colder in the winter than Stanley Lake would be. So I don't think you can count on it being too cold for Stanley Lake. And by the same token, it's certainly not going to be too hot. They like Lake Mead and Lake Havasu really well, and that water is much hotter than Stanley Lake. So the temperature, I don't think, would be a limiting factor for mussels here.
What would be your solution to work towards the boats coming back?
Mine personally, or Chris's?
Either, I mean.
I guess I heard a lot of the things, kind of the one boat, one lake idea. An immediate thing that I think would certainly be a solution. I know that probably isn't favorable because you have a lot more boats than you have locked up, but certainly if you had something where boats were willing to be restricted to Stanley Lake, that would, to me, sort of be the ideal solution. Then you don't have to worry about something coming in from somewhere else, or you're always going to have somebody that tries to cheat the system and finds a way around whatever it is. So that would be my concern in terms of not going to something like that. But again, that's just based on what I was hearing at the other meeting. I don't think there's an ideal solution where everybody's going to be happy. People are going to want to boat that follow the rules, that would like to come in, and they're the ones I sympathize with because they're doing everything right, but they're going to be limited if you go to that type of a solution. Kelly?
I concur with Chris completely. I think if there's a will, there's a way. People will figure some way of getting around whatever we put in place. I think if we can contain those boats at Stanley and come up with some solution on how to track them when there's maintenance or something like that, I think that's our best option.
Okay, thank you.
What is a predator of a zebra mussel?
In their home grounds, which is in Europe, there's a fish called the round goby, which is a little fish that eats the mussels and does a reasonable job of keeping them under control. Those fish are in Lake Michigan and the Great Lakes. They probably got there the same way that the mussels did, which was in ballast water from the ships. They haven't controlled them there either. The disadvantage is they'll get rid of some of the native fish. So you don't want to bring in the natural predators from Europe to take care of the mussels here. There's red-eared sunfish supposedly will eat them to some degree. There's some evidence that channel catfish might eat them. There are fish that will eat them, but I'm not aware of any that will eat them to the degree that they can keep them under control in the United States.
See, you guys have some visual aids. Did you want to talk about those at all?
They kind of speak for themselves, I think. These are just some of the plate settlers I don't know if it's the boar.
Is that Wynn Baldwin probably?
Yeah.
Wynn was a volunteer with the Park Service down at Lake Mead, and he had a pretty good business going just throwing things on ropes in there, and 6 months later he'd pull this stuff out.
Yeah.
So I think everybody working on mussels in the western United States probably has one of Wynn's propellers.
I have to ask, though, is Lake Mead comparable to Stanley Lake? Are the other lakes that you're finding these zebra mussels, are they comparable to Stanley Lake?
Lake Mead is much higher in calcium. It is much warmer. pH would be similar, but there's just a lot of variability. No.
Okay. So we're comparing something that could happen in a different environment, and we're comparing it to Stanley Lake.
Except, again, Lake Mead, obviously, for whatever reason, actually Lake Mead, Lake Havasu, I think, is the place they like best of anywhere in the country, as near as we can tell. There are more mussels there, and they grow faster and bigger. The the scientists over the years have developed a set of conditions. Again, that's where I mentioned the calluses. Calcium and pH to me are the big two. And for those two variables, Stanley Lake is in the highly favorable range for muscle growth.
So why are we not seeing any other muscles in Colorado?
That is a question I sure wish I could answer for you, because if we knew that, that would
so you can say, no, we don't have zebra mussels in Colorado.
No. I can say,
we
do not have the problems that other lakes have had where they get out of control.
Okay.
I would be willing to bet that somewhere in Colorado, there's a couple lakes that have mussels in them that just are in such low levels that they haven't become a problem.
So do you believe, and have you seen the demo of the prevention of the tagging the boat to the trailer and the quarantine process? Do you feel with that robust system that zebra mussels could be introduced into Stanley Lake?
I would say the likelihood is low, but I would never say never. Again, it gets back to the mussels growing in the boat motors and other things. There are always places in boats where no matter how much you inspect it or how much you wash it, there's going to be some water in there somewhere where a mussel where a villager can survive.
Understand. And so in these lakes, boats are allowed to dock and stay overnight in the water. Mm-hmm. Stanley Lake does not do that. All boats are removed from dusk till dawn.
Mm-hmm. That certainly is in your favor, definitely, because you don't have the longer exposure period.
Can zebra mussels attach to a boat within, how long does it take them to attach to a boat?
It's not the attaching to the boat I would worry about. It would be the villagers that were in the boat to begin with that would be released into the lake that could then spawn and grow in the lake. So it would be what was in the water within the boat, not that they would become attached to the boats in that 2-hour time period.
So based upon a 30-day quarantine, that is not feasible, right?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
So on a 35-day quarantine, do zebra mussels live on a boat in a ballast tank?
That's another question I wish I could tell you 100% that I was sure of. I looked at the 100th Meridian website before the last meeting, because that's where the quarantine information was. For some reason, they've taken that quarantine information off that website, and I don't know why.
Do they need oxygen to live?
Yes.
Do they need food to live in a ballast tank?
Yes.
Okay.
But they don't need a whole lot of food.
They need oxygen, right?
Yeah, they do need oxygen.
Okay.
In fact, that's one of the theories as to why they came to this country when they did. It was back in the 70s and 80s when the rivers were getting cleaned up in Europe that formerly all the dead zones in the European rivers were keeping them from reaching the ports in the ocean where they then could come across the sea, where before they all died before they ever got there, so they weren't in the ballast tanks until the water got cleaner in the European rivers.
Can mussel larvae live in the ballast tanks for longer periods of time than an adult mussel with the oxygen and food and not being there?
The larvae are going to become adults. I mean, that's until they die. But yeah, at some point they do. They could attach and they could live in those balanced tanks if they had sufficient nutrients and oxygen.
Thank you.
What about birds? So I'm an avid fisherman, mm-hmm. and I like to hike to lakes where nobody can go to. And I say, how are these fish here?
The
Canadian geese?
That has been postulated that it may be possible. I'm aware of one lake where they think they've demonstrated it. Not a lake. It's a golf course pond at Lake Havasu that is not connected to Lake Havasu itself. So again, there's lots of mussels in the water around it. The golf course pond was not fed by lake water. It was fed, I don't recall if it was well water or filtered water or a combination, but the golf course manager swears that it had to be the geese because he couldn't see any other way for it to get in. So it may be possible, but I don't know how likely it is. You know, it's kind of the same thing. It's how far do the geese have to fly? How well will the villagers be able to live in the goose feathers before they go from one spot to another? But it, I would say it's a remote possibility.
I would think it would have to be a close... I mean, as a wildlife biologist, I would think it would have to be a close...
I think that's why the situational lab...
Lake to lake.
Yeah, Lake Havasu was a fairly unique situation where they only had to fly a matter of a few hundred yards to get from a highly contaminated body of water to one that had been clean.
Okay.
Are there any other questions?
Chris, appreciate your time.
Welcome.
Jason, are all the staff, is Chris going to be available at future meetings in case questions come up?
So we're gonna work as hard as we can to be here. I know Chris has a conflict for a period of time.
The next two weeks.
However, we can I think access you with quick questions, but you can also come back to assist. So
yes.
Other than that, a staff as well as any other resources that the task force would like to come and visit and go over various topics, we can certainly line that up as expeditiously as possible. Just whatever you guys would like.
Everybody ready for a break? We've been going at it for an hour and 10 minutes. Sound good?
Sounds great.
So maybe seven minutes okay?
Yeah, that's perfect.
Yep. Together at 7:20.
Perfect, thanks.